Yes, I'm, yes, I'm, yes, I'm. You make me feel so real. Make me feel so real. From the first time.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Uprising View podcast. My name is Everett, and I'm here with Stephen, as always. We are coming to you on the wonderful afternoon here. As we are speaking, the UK is probably electing a new prime minister. I'm not sure if they finished yet or not because I haven't watched the news, but that is what's been going on here. We decided we wanted to record some extra podcasts this week, and we had some extra ideas, so we wanted to float these out to you guys. And also, I want to extend a thanks to all the writers on Twitter and Gab who are apparently responding very well to our podcast number 5, which was the podcast about exploring your voice. That seems to be getting a lot of traction. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a big issue that a lot of writers struggle with, and especially even more experienced writers. I think they're really, at some point you realize, wow, I need to figure out, I need to have a purpose and a goal or something that people can, that readers can really identify with. So, yeah.
Yeah, you need to be your own writer. I mean, there are a lot of people, I think, that want to be Tom Clancy or, you know, J.K. Rowling or whatever, but ultimately you need to be your own writer. And I'm really glad people are responding to that podcast. I don't want to get off on a tangent here because we do have a topic for this podcast, and it's an important topic that pretty much every writer deals with. But we want to thank you guys for passing that around. If you like our work, share it, show it to a friend, listen to a friend. We're on iTunes. Like, subscribe, pass it around. That's how you share the love. That's all we ask. Today's topic is going to be something that every writer, new or veteran, has encountered, and that is conflict. And yeah, so conflict is something I've been thinking of writing a blog post about just because it's been on my mind a lot lately. I've been reading some more military history lately. I've been reading a little bit about the conflict between Florence and Venice in the Renaissance for a book I'm writing, and I've just been realizing that there's this old adage in military history that difference plus proximity equals conflict. And that's something that I have never been told in any of the many, many, many books on writing that I have read over the years. And every book on writing says conflict, conflict, conflict. It pushes conflict. You have to have conflict. But they don't tell you how to create it. And that formula, difference plus proximity equals conflict, solved for me a lot of problems.
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, we always hear how important conflict is. And you know, I think back to a story that I was writing many years ago. I just remember I was trying to add, you know, more conflict, more, intrigue into it. And, you know, I was thinking specifically of, you know, all the movies that I watched that had, you know, really complex plots, and just the more nuanced and, the better, really, just the more conflict and mystery that I added, kind of the better, at least for that story, certainly was going to come out. But I also, thinking we were just kind of talking about it, before we started, is that, you know, not every great story needs conflict, or needs a lot of conflict. Necessarily.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of stories that have a kind of a philosophical or an ideological bent to it. And, you know, this is kind of true, especially in things like Russian literature, which I really love, which does have conflict, but not everything is about conflict. They have characters that are just allowed to be pensive. They have characters that are just allowed to be philosophical and thoughtful and to wonder about things, rather than, you know, just always being in conflict with something. And whenever I think of conflict, whenever I go back to the books that I read starting out back in the 90s and early 2000s, I think that they were working off of a Hollywood version of conflict, which is, if there's two people in a room, there needs to be a gun on the table, and there needs to be something going on. And if you don't have that going on, you're going to lose your audience. And I think that that might work in the context of movies, but for a book, for a novel, not really. For a novel, you, the writer, are allowed to do things like stop the plot and just talk. You can't do that in a movie. A director can't just stop the movie and talk to you, really.
Yeah, you know, personally, I don't think that really works in movies either. And I think we're kind of seeing that with just the decline of interest in movies. And now everything has to be, you know, a blockbuster or it flops kind of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of the curse of nerddom, you know. A little bit of brief history here. There, back in 1977, when the first Star Wars came out, Hollywood was kind of overtaken with this book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, written by Joseph Campbell. And people really gravitated to that and thought, okay, here's George Lucas. He has figured out the plot. He has figured out the way to make a blockbuster movie, and we're going to follow that. And everybody has followed it ever since. And you know, or at least for the major movies, for some of the smaller movies, not necessarily. But, you know, the big blockbusters, certainly everything that's been done that's come out of nerd culture since, you know, 99 when Spider-Man came out. No, 99 is when X-Men came out. X-Men, Spider-Man, Lord of the Rings, that kind of era, when nerds became ascendant, the Hero with a Thousand Faces really, really became the standard. And finding conflict through those archetypes is something that every book you read emphasizes to you. And, you know, to me, I'm not so sure that I agree with that anymore, because I think The Hero with a Thousand Faces is good for, I think, like a coming-of-age story. It's like Star Wars. It's good for a buildings roman. But it's not necessarily good if you're trying to write something like I write, like a piece of historical fiction that deals with adults that are already adults who have their lives underway, you know?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite writers is John Irving. And his novels really don't have conflict in the general sense that we think of conflict, you know, gun on a table kind of thing you were just mentioned. A lot of the conflict in his stories is, you know, revolves around, you know, strange, interesting sexual situations or, you know, it's very real life conflict, very much, fictionalized, but very real conflict, very, you know, things that we might, you know, experience in our everyday lives that are just, it's not the kind of, you know, Hollywood drummed up conflict that we think of when we think of conflict. And so when you're reading it, it's the plot is very, very much, it's very realistic, I guess, but it's very, it doesn't have conflict for conflict's sake, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. And yeah, I really enjoy his books, simply because they aren't, you know, it's kind of a change of pace from a lot of the science fiction I may read that's got, you know, a conflict between an alien race or something like that. It's very, just his writing style is just very different from a lot of the Hollywood, generic conflict that we see. And I think that's something that more writers should think about embracing.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sitting here looking at the stack of books that I have and that I love. And I realize that you don't love all of these books because some of them have like The Great Gatsby in it, and Lolita is there, and As I Lay Dying by Faulkner. But, you know, I'm thinking none of these books really have that sort of central protagonist antagonist conflict that we're always pushed to explore in writing books. And
absolutely. And yeah. I think a Lolita is actually a really good example, because there is certainly conflict there, but you don't see the same kind of, it's a very personal level of conflict, and it's very complex.
Yeah. And there are times in Lolita when there very much is conflict. Humbert has conflict in himself as he is trying to seduce Lolita. And for those of you who haven't read it, there isn't actually any sex in the book. It's just, like, the sexiest it gets is just some leering at her legs one time. But it's implied. You know what's going on. But, yeah, being written in the 1950s, it's not a pornographic novel at all. It's just, it's a story about the American road is what it is. And a pastoral is what it is, I guess you could say. And that is really the core of that novel. And things like, you know, much of Ernest Hemingway's writing. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily got these direct conflicts in it. It has a different kind of conflict. It has a mature conflict. It has, as I said before, proximity plus difference. So whenever, you know, I'm looking here at The Sun Also Rises, and I'm thinking, you know, the conflict is an internal conflict, really. And it's one of those, I think, four types of conflicts that they tell you about in books and in writing classes. But his conflict is the result of differences between himself, between who he was in the past and between who he would like to be and who he would like to be with Brett, I think is her name. It is a very complex conflict. It's not the, you know, you're my enemy, I have to defeat you a conflict that we're always told we need from writing books.
So I guess my, you know, I just a question. How do you, as a writer who maybe, you know, is you know, thinking about writing a, you know, a very, you know, general conflict, you know, a typical, you know, good versus bad type of conflict, how do I go about doing that without, without turning into the generic, you know, Hollywood type of plot, if that's not,
Well, I would say maybe the thing you want to avoid is if you want to avoid the general Hollywood blockbuster type of plot, try to avoid the three act structure. Try to avoid the introduction, the setting up, the rising conflict, the point of no return that you often see in books on plotting. Try to avoid the growing tension conflict to a denouement, and then the resolution. If you try to avoid that, I think you'll have a very good way of examining conflict. So maybe what you really need is not really one or two characters. What you need is maybe a nice pantheon of characters, maybe five or six characters that you're working with. And this is a little complex. It was for me when I wrote my book Autumn Leaves, which is quite complex. It has four main characters and, you know, probably 30 smaller characters that just kind of make appearances. But each one of those characters has their own conflicts that they deal with, and each one of those characters has their own plot that they deal with, and they interact. And it's the same way with all of my historical fiction. Characters interact with each other, and what I do, because I don't really write the Buildings Roman, I don't write the coming-of-age story, I try to give them a goal, and then let them meet that goal, and then give them another goal, and then so forth and so on, until I am satisfied that I have explored every aspect of the society, every aspect of the character that I want. I don't have a great overarching goal that they have to get to. I don't have a princess that has to be rescued. I don't have, you know, a sword that needs to be won, a father that needs to be avenged. I don't really get into that kind of stuff. Does that make sense? Does that kind of help you explain a little how you might avoid cliche conflicts?
Yeah, you know, it does. And, you know, I was even just thinking of, like, Harry Potter and how well J.K. Rowling, I think that's a reason why she's so successful, because she deals with conflicts so well. And that there is certainly an overarching conflict to her stories, but that's not really what makes that so her book so successful. It's really the conflict that goes on throughout that maybe isn't contributes certainly to the main theme, but has, you know, very real and very, different, conflicts that lead up to that with each character.
Yeah, every scene is not about Harry versus Voldemort. Every scene is about Harry evolving in some way, or Hermione changing in some way, or, you know, one of the other minor characters enduring something. And what we see is Harry is not simply a vehicle for conflict. He's not simply a character that we're going to watch change. He's a character we're going to watch change other people too. And that is kind of one of the keys to, I think, having a very multidimensional character in a multidimensional book that really stays with people. You know, I'm thinking pretty much of the history books I've read, because I trained in history, and one of the things I've learned over reading many a biography of great men and great leaders is that they not only have challenges and conflicts in their own life, but that they're also comfortable playing the role of best friend or confidant or, you know, agent of change to other people. And I think if you as a writer sit down and allow your protagonist to explore other or to serve as other roles to other people, depending on what's going on in the story, I think that helps to create the multidimensional aspect that readers really love. And it helps to move the story along without having to have that cliche conflict in every single scene, you know?
That's a really great point, and I love that example because, you know, we really do in our own lives. If you think about it, we're not necessarily the protagonist in every situation. You know, we are constantly changing depending on the, you know, what we need to be. And I think that's really important to bring to our characters as well, is that they're not always going to be, you know, the main focal point in every single conflict. Maybe they are the best friend at certain times, and I think that's something that movies definitely, the trap that they fall into, is that, you know, it's always about the main character, when in reality, it's not like that. And I think that novelists and writers certainly have an advantage in that respect, that we can achieve that much more easily.
Yeah, that's probably true. I'm thinking of Lord of the Rings. I mean, think of Frodo. I mean, Frodo, Lord of the Rings is one of my favorite novels of all time, but and I think many people would agree. But Frodo is the main character in a way, but the story isn't always about him. The story is sometimes about him as a friend to Samwise. Sometimes it's the story is Frodo as kind of a ward of Gandalf. And sometimes he is the hero when he is called on to take the ring. Sometimes he is afraid. Sometimes he is, you know, not always this character that's blazing forward, you know, single-mindedly doing exactly what he has to do. And that's part of the success of Lord of the Rings, is that there are times when, you know, other characters are allowed, you know, Gimli, Legolas, Boromir, whatever, are allowed to kind of take the spotlight for a moment and have their relationship with the Fellowship of the Ring, with Frodo, examined, or with their relations with each other. You know, the kind of interesting little conflict, I guess you could say friendly conflict between Legolas and Gimli is kind of there as well. But also one of the things that I love about Lord of the Rings is that it's kind of a book that can't be written today and published by a major publisher, because it'll talk to you. It'll explore an idea, and it will allow that idea to be explored. It'll put the conflict to the side for a moment and say, this is the world that we're in. Let's talk about this world for a minute. And that really gives a lot of depth to the conflict that we see whenever characters are, you know, engaged in some sort of a conflict with Uruk-hai or something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's another great example, probably a better example than J.K. Rowling. But, you know, I think a lot of writers will give J.K. Rowling flack because, you know, whatever reason, they say she's not a good writer or whatever, but I think a lot of those criticisms really fail to see or recognize that the reason she is successful is because of that conflict. And for the exact same reason that Tolkien was successful, is it really does deal with those characters on a very interdimensional level. And so they do come across as very complex, and the conflict is very is very real to the reader, even though in both situations we're dealing with you know, a world that is complex and something that's very unlike the world that we currently live in. But in both cases we understand the personal conflicts that they deal with.
Yeah, and there's another idea just sort of popped into my mind, and that is Jane Austen novels. A lot of people, a few years ago, Jane Austen really became very popular for some reason, at least among many of the women I know. It was about the time that the, that vampire thing that, what was it? It was the vampire with, and the werewolf that were in love with that underage girl from Seattle or something. Yeah, Twilight. And, there was this movement among a lot of young women that I knew who were picking up Jane Austen and reading it. And I think about, and I've read, I think, 3 Jane Austen novels. And one of the things that I perceive about conflict in a Jane Austen novel is that the big conflicts to her are actually social conflicts. They're conflicts that exist not necessarily internal to the characters, although that is where we feel attention. They're conflicts between, you know, or that exist because of the rules of society, the manners of the day. And one of the things that I think you can do to avoid writing a kind of cliche story is, you know, examine the world you live in or examine the world you're writing in and know that world very well. And that's something we touched on in one of the previous podcasts. But, you know, isn't it really the case that a lot of conflict could come from something like, you know, simply a person existing in their own world? Maybe, you know, my grandmother used to tell me that a woman's life was a struggle between what she wants and what is expected of her. And that's something that I've always taken when I write female characters. And that kind of conflict is something that I see in Jane Austen novels. That's something I see in most novels that are written by women is that you have this conflict between what you want to do and what is expected of you. And that is kind of maybe another way to express conflict without being really Hollywood cliche about it, you know?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. I mean, I think that's something we can all kind of deal with. You know, we all have expectations, whether it's external or of ourselves, that we want to reach. And that's something that a lot of, you know, the traditional Hollywood conflict that we think of doesn't always deal with on a personal level. I mean, it does to a point, but, you know, I think a lot of that conflict we see really either glazes over that or doesn't deals with it in more of a cliche way, as opposed to, you know, it doesn't connect, it fails to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that kind of conflict, you mentioned it fails to connect, and that's a very good observation. The reason it fails to connect is because we have seen it so many times by the time that we're 30 years old that it doesn't matter to us anymore. And I think that's part of why Hollywood especially focuses on young people, because they can pull the same shit for years and years and years. And they always have a new audience, because there's always a new crop of 16-year-old guys taking 16-year-old girls out on dates.
Yeah, no, and over the years, I've just been so kind of frustrated. I guess probably the wrong way to put it. But yeah, I just don't go to the movies anymore. You know, because, you know, all my friends go, and I'm like, yeah, I'll save the you know, $12 or whatever. Because it's just, you know, you see the same thing over and over again. I mean, if there's something really good out, yeah, I'll go. But, you know, I miss, and this is totally a topic for another podcast too, but, you know, I miss the great stories like, you know, growing up, you know, I would go over to my grandparents and I would see, what's the name of that movie? 12 Angry Men about the...
The Jury, yeah, it's a good one.
The Jury. And, you know, for some reason, even though I was... I must have been, you know, like 12 when I saw that movie or something. It's not a movie a 12-year-old would necessarily see, but for some reason, you know, I sat down and got really into that movie. And it's something I always think back on, because it's just, it was such a great, you know, well put together, complex film. And, you know, it's a shame that we don't see that type of conflict, even in books, really, that much.
Yeah. When I think back to great movies that I really like, one of the things that really had an impact on me growing up was Braveheart. And that's because not only had I never seen anything like it before, I don't think I had ever really experienced a movie that existed on such a scope before, because I did not know much about David Lean before seeing Braveheart. I didn't know, you know, my idea of an epic was, you know, a Star Wars space epic. And then in 1994, I think it was, 95, Braveheart comes out. And, you know, the central conflict of Braveheart is, you know, the struggle for a country, But it's also, the conflict is, you know, you have William Wallace's internal conflict about Marin, who was murdered, essentially to bring him out of hiding by the English. And, you know, their central conflict is kind of, it's really off the page, isn't it? The battles have conflict, obviously, but, you know, there are so many different conflicts going on in Braveheart that the only thing you can do is say, it's the struggle for national identity. It's the struggle for nationhood. It's the struggle to be recognized as a people sovereign unto yourselves. But then you have all these other little conflicts going on, like the conflict between Robert the Bruce and his leper father, and the conflict that exists between Robert the Bruce and William Wallace. And you have conflicts playing into other conflicts, and that is just brilliant on every level. And, you know, that's something I think we could learn a hell of a lot from.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think I actually just thought of a great way to frame this kind of. So, you know, we all understand personal conflict. I mean, we all deal with it. And we all, you know, we all probably have a goal or something that we want to reach. And so, you know, thinking of, you know, a historical figure, you know, we could take, you know, Napoleon. He had a goal that he wanted to reach. And, you know, I think we all kind of understand that overarching goal. You know, he was, you know, conquering territory, but
yeah, unify Europe,
right? But on a more personal level, what else plays into that? What sort of, you know, personal conflict did he deal with? Was it, you know, maybe, and I don't know the history that well, but maybe he, you know, what personal challenges did he face? You know, was it a personal?
Well, first of all, you have the relationship between Napoleon and Josephine, and that was in many ways the defining relationship of his life. I think her name was Josephine. It was the defining relationship of his life. He wrote many letters to her. He wrote, you know, in some ways there are some historians who think he was trying to unify Europe for her. And then you have the ideological struggle. You know, you have the notion of Europe as Europe, you know, a united Europe that hadn't existed really since Charlemagne, I think what it was. And he saw himself in that light. And that's another conflict that he has, this sort of the conflict between who you see yourself as and who you actually are. And, you know, there's that conflict. And then you had, I guess, racial conflict too, because Napoleon was not French. Napoleon was Corsican. And for those of you that don't know, Corsicans do not consider themselves French. Whenever the I'm not going to get into politics too much here, but they are a very nationalist group. They are French by law, but they view themselves as quite something different. And during the French election, that was made very clear to both Macron and Le Pen that, you know, hey, you're not us, but we will vote in your election. But, you know, that's another internal struggle for Napoleon. And really, I think one of the things you're going to do if you're going to write a big story, an epic story, you're going to have to deal with multi-layered conflicts. But I think they all need to come under the cope of one giant conflict. In Star Wars, that cope is essentially to be free of the Empire. In Braveheart, it is your own nation. I'm looking sort of at my books collection here, just thinking, you know, Indiana Jones. I mean, is there an overarching conflict? Really not. There's one per each movie, of course. But maybe that's the thing that makes Indiana Jones a little less impressive than Star Wars, you know? And it's the same thing with, like, Pirates of the Caribbean. Pirates of the Caribbean does not have one overarching goal. Each movie is just its own kind of thing, you know?
As a writer, as a storyteller, we definitely need to be better recognizing that that these smaller interpersonal or even just relational conflicts are such an important part of a story, and they more than even in many ways more than the main conflict, they really are the story, or can be what drives your story, because that's what's going to get people's emotions into it. That's what's going to really connect with people. Not the overarching, you know, not the big battle at the end.
Yeah, that's like what keeps the page turning. And that's one of the things I was reading about a year ago, I guess. I was reading Hugh Howey's books, the Silo books. And one of the things that I noticed about the first book, which was it called Wool, I think is what it was called. It's not Shift, is it?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's Wool. Hugh Howey's book Wool, which takes place in a silo. If you read this, you will notice that, you know, you're halfway through the book before the main plot takes over. But up until that point, there have been smaller conflicts that exist between characters that are essentially killed off. I don't want to ruin the book for you. I'm not going to do that, but it's a good book. If you haven't read it, read it. But there are little mini conflicts that exist without or within the context of Wool. And, you know, it doesn't have this big overarching thing until you really get kind of into it a little bit. But those smaller conflicts are what make you turn the page just to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, and thinking back to Lord of the Rings, was there any doubt that Frodo would end up destroying the ring throughout the entire trilogy? Was there any doubt that any of that would happen? Was there any doubt that Middle-earth would defeat Mordor? Not really. We really knew how it was going to end. So then, why was it interesting? Why did we keep wanting to read it? Why were the movies so successful if we knew the resolution already? I mean, it really is
because of those micro conflicts.
Absolutely.
Because the smaller conflicts, the conflicts between Frodo and Sam, the you know, Sam, I have to go this alone, the no, Mr. Frodo, I can't let you go alone, those kind of conflicts, those conflicts that are real, the kind of conflicts that you would see or that you would hope you'd see in your own friends, you know, or, you know, the kind of things that just ring true to us, or that are not necessarily even realistically true, but that are true in a way that we would want them to be true. And maybe that's what makes fantasy fantasy. Fantasy, at its best, has truth the way we want it to be, rather than the way it is.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
But yeah, that's... I was going to actually go into, you know, sort of... I thought when we were talking about doing this, maybe we would do the different types of conflict in man versus self, man versus nature, man versus thing, but that's been done to death. I think we did a pretty good job talking about conflicts and micro-conflicts and major conflicts, and I think we did a good job with this one here.
No, I do too. I think I actually learned a lot just, you know, thinking through it and getting to talk about it.
Yeah, and for me, I think it ultimately goes back, everything that I've been saying through this podcast ultimately goes back to that thought that I had the other day when I was reading about conflict, that proximity plus difference equals conflict. You know, the Frodo and Samwise, I mean, difference. They have different feelings, you know, towards their goal. You know, Harry Potter and Hermione sometimes have different feelings towards the same goal. They're not always on the same page. If they did, it would be kind of redundant, you know. There would be an echo of each other. You know, if you had Harry Potter say, well, we really need to get this Horcrux. And then Hermione says, yeah, we really need to get this Horcrux. I agree. I mean, is that really interesting? No, it's not. So, yeah, that's something that you as a writer and I as a writer and everybody listening to this as a writer should probably take a very important look at when you're reading or going through your work or setting up your story. You know, that kind of the micro conflicts are important as well. But yeah, that is I think that's a pretty good job for today. Let's bring this on home and say a few words. If you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes, like it, give us 5 stars, leave a review, share it on Twitter, as we've seen with podcast number 5. You know, share it to your writing friends, get it out there, and talk to each other. Talk to us. We love hearing from you. podcast@uprisingreview.com is our email address. I don't think there's anything else we need to say. We don't really have any announcements for this week, do we, on the website? Yeah, we're recording this a little ahead of time, so I don't know what story we'll be releasing this same week. But, you know, yeah, uprisingreview.com, new stories every Monday, new podcasts every Thursday, link roundup on Friday. Sometimes we have stuff on Tuesday, sometimes we don't. Wednesday, it's an interview with one of our writers. Check us out every day. Share it if you like it. Tell a friend. We love you guys. We want to hear from you. And if you have ideas for podcasts, anything you want to talk about, send it on over. So for Stephen, I'm Everett, and we have been the Uprising Review. Thank you.
So we exchange names and contacts, now that got we locked in this deep conversation. You are tell about your hopes and dreams, I just tell you about my life and thy situation. Now you say you want come chill with the natty out, open your arms, never lock a your girl, you mean so much more than what meets the eye.